This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. As law enforcement agencies throughout the nation continue to face challenges brought about by the current economic changes, it is increasingly important that these agencies find innovative ways to ensure the safety of the public. We are facing a new reality in American policing, one that requires a shift in the methods used to ensure public safety while also dealing with ever-shrinking budgets. In that vein, many in the law enforcement community recognize the importance of maintaining and expanding community policing practices. In the end, it's all about building partnerships and solving community problems. What is community policing, and how does it contribute to the safety of neighborhoods and communities? What is the mission of the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services? How has the era of fiscal austerity changed the way law enforcement operates? And how can technology enhance community policing? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Bernard Malekian, Director of the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services within the U.S. Department of Justice. Welcome, Bernard. It's great to have you on the show.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Melinda Balthrop. Melinda, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Bernard, I'd like to start off by providing some context. Would you provide us with a brief history and overview of the mission of the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, or COPS? When was it created, and how has its mission evolved to date?
My pleasure to do so. You know, the office started back in the mid-90s, really to advance community policing throughout the United States. Community policing was a philosophy that had been articulated but really intermittently implemented across the country. It coincided with a push by the administration of President Clinton to put 100,000 police officers on the streets of America. And hopefully for those officers to advance community policing. The good news was, of course, that that objective was achieved. But the challenge that it presented was that it politicized the office to some degree. The question really became, is the mission of the COPS office to advance community policing, to advance public safety through community policing, or was it a jobs program? What we've tried to do over the intervening years and the funding levels and the programs that we fund have risen and fallen. But what we've tried to do over the last few years is to make it very clear that our mission is to help local law enforcement make the communities that they serve safer. And we do that through a variety of means.
And I'd like to touch on that. I get a sense of the scale of operation of your office. How is it organized? What's the size of its budget? And more particularly, what's the size of its grants portfolio?
You know, the size of the grants portfolio varies from year to year, and it varies depending on how many programs we have. This year, for example, we had roughly $111 million in hiring grants. That's down almost 90% from 3 years ago when we had $1 billion as part of the Recovery Act. And the focus of those hiring grants is to enable local law enforcement agencies to hire additional officers to address specific community problems. This year, we also had roughly $12 million for community policing development projects, and we fund various research efforts designed to produce reports, produce data that hopefully law enforcement agencies across the country can look at, and if they've got a specific problem, and say, you know what, we could use that and learn from it.
Bernard, I'd like to transition to your role leading the COPS office. Can you talk about your specific responsibilities and duties as the director, and how you support the overall mission of the Department of Justice?
I think without question, the role of the director is if I was designing a coat of arms, I think I would do two things. I would have a compass to say we're going to go this way. When I talk about advancing public safety through community policing, I believe that's a mission statement. But I would also believe that I need to provide an umbrella. One of the things I have been absolutely struck by is the dedication of the men and women of the office and their commitment to this mission. Part of my job, I think, is to help them do that and to help deal with the realities of Washington and the political environment we're in and let them do their work. I also get to interact with the field a great deal. It's my favorite part of my job. I've visited 32 states and two foreign countries, and in the 3 years that I've been in this job, I have talked to law enforcement leaders, chiefs and sheriffs, as well as line personnel around this country. And really gotten a feel for the challenges that they're facing, particularly in this economy. So it's very exciting. It's a very exciting job to have.
So Bernard, I'd like to sort of focus internally a little bit and possibly externally and look at the top management challenges you face. What are some of the top management challenges you face, and how have you sought to address them?
Well, without question, certainly, the issue of hiring and budgets and economies. I mean, every federal agency is under hiring freeze. Every federal agency, the federal workforce has been, I think, 2 years now, coming on three, without a pay increase. Those are sort of internal morale issues. And the economy has really played havoc with local law enforcement agencies and the expectations of the office. I think the first year that I was there, it was a fairly continual stream of local officials, chiefs, sheriffs, mayors, saying our budget is being wiped out. Can you help us? And trying to explain that that's not the role of the office, that we want to focus on helping them solve specific problems. But all of that presents a challenge in an environment where as people leave, they're not replaced. And we have to figure out different ways to do business. Those have presented challenges, but they've also presented some pretty unique opportunities in terms of realigning, looking at workflow, looking at, we've done things a certain way for quite some time, and now we have to look at doing it differently, which is the same thing we're telling the law enforcement field. You have to do it differently. So it certainly has not been a boring 3 years.
Perhaps you can give us a little bit of your background, actually. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
I've been a police officer. I was a police officer for 36 years. I started out at the Santa Monica, California Police Department. I spent a year with the Santa Barbara County Sheriffs, and then I came back to Santa Monica. And in 1996, I had the privilege of being selected as the police chief in Pasadena. My career was very operational. I was the first dog handler in Los Angeles County back in the 70s. It's hard to even say that. And I spent a lot of time on tactical operations teams and those kind of things. At the same time, and I think one of the things that might be interesting to people, I don't know, is a great deal of my life as I was working and raising a family and doing those things was spent going to school. It took me 10 years to get a bachelor's degree. It took me 6 years to get a master's degree. It took me 8 years to get a doctorate. So everything I was doing at the same time, I was interacting with people sort of outside of the law enforcement realm. And that is not as insignificant as it might seem. Certainly changed my perspective. I also served in the Coast Guard Reserve for 25 years, and that included two active duty deployments. I was the only one of three police chiefs in the country in 2003 to be on active duty. I retired from both the police department and the Coast Guard in 2009 when I came here. I'm very glad to have gotten to do all of that.
So with that background and that vast experience, both with the Coast Guard and as a police chief, what makes an effective leader?
I think there are several things. I think you have to have clarity of vision, clarity of focus, what it is you want to do and where you want to go. Secondly, you have to have faith in the people who work for you. You have to have faith that you have trained them and developed them and brought them along in a way that's meaningful. I often used to tell young cops, I think sometimes thinking maybe they're going to score points or something, would say, well, tell us, you know, what we should do about this or that, some tactical operational thing. And I would say I try to never confuse what I know with what I knew. I think that's not an unimportant aspect, because these young people that are doing this work, whether it's in police work or in the federal government, are really incredibly dedicated and smart. And that's what I meant about a compass. I also think you have to have integrity and transparency. You absolutely have to do what you say you're going to do, not just on the big things, but on the day-to-day things. I actually, when I go to meetings, especially if it's with employee groups or stakeholder groups, I always make sure someone's with me to write down what it is I say I'm going to do, because it's very easy in a conversation, and it's not malicious, but it's very easy to say I'm going to do this, and then you forget it. And then what you don't think about it because you forgot it, but the person says, oh, well, that person told me that they were going to do this and they didn't, and they formed an opinion. So I think integrity, and I think also transparency. How do you make the decisions? Why do you make the decisions? One of the most valuable leadership lessons that I got came from being on active duty in the Coast Guard and in my subsequent years of drilling, because I was not, I was a search and rescue boat driver, a harbor security boat driver. I retired as an E-7. I was a first line supervisor in the Coast Guard. That's what I wanted to do. The point of that is that I would leave the police department where I was the chief of police and go down and be a first line supervisor in a completely different organization, sometimes on the same day. And it was very interesting. People used to ask me, well, what was the hardest part of being on active duty? Or what was the best part of being on active duty? I said, well, you know, I wasn't in charge of everything. I just did what they told me to do. And he said, well, what was the worst part? And I said, well, I wasn't in charge of everything, and I had to do what they told me to do. So I think those things, and I think caring or compassion, if that's a word, the right word for the people who actually do the work.
What is community policing? We will ask Bernard Malekian, Director of the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services within DOJ, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? What is being done to ensure the safety and soundness of the country's credit union system? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more wisely? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative new technologies and open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Bernard Malekian, Director of the Office of Community-Oriented Policing, or COPS program, within U.S. Department of Justice. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Melinda Balthrop. So, Bernard, you mentioned that the mission of your office is to advance public safety through the implementation of community policing strategies. I'd like to understand the philosophy that defines community policing. Can you tell us what that actually is, and would you elaborate on, like, three components?
Certainly. You know, one of the interesting things is my career has in some ways paralleled the development of community policing, and it's been interesting to watch it evolve and watch the awareness of it evolve. Community policing, and the COPS office definition, and certainly one that I adopt, is that it's designed around building relationships, building partnerships, number one. Number two, solving problems. Partnerships between law enforcement and the community it serves to address specific neighborhood issues. And thirdly, is an organizational transformation within the law enforcement agency. At some point, and I think this has been the sticking point, at some point, community policing has to cease to be a project or a series of special projects, and it has to become the operating philosophy of the organization. When that transformation occurs, then you can say that community policing has arrived. One of the challenges that the economy has produced in law enforcement, and very often I will have law enforcement leaders come in and see me and talk about, well, you know, I've had to cut my budget. I have to eliminate my community policing officers. I have to cut my community policing programs. I understand what they're saying. But I also understand it means that they're still at the stage where community policing is a project. It's not the operating philosophy of the organization. So I think those three points, I think it has taken a while for people to arrive there, for agencies to arrive there. I don't want to bog down in a lot of detail unless you'd like me to, but I think that for the most part, most agencies, I think, have run community policing and run sort of traditional reactive policing in tandem. And as long as the economy allowed them to do that, the conflict could be minimized. But when you look at what's happened to law enforcement across the country in terms of loss of resources, loss of positions, now they're having to make a choice between how do we integrate that traditional model with the community policing model. And that the verdict is still out on how that's going to shape out.
Interesting. So before we delve into specific initiatives, I'd like to get a sense of your key strategic priorities that you focused on during your tenure as the head of COPS. What are they?
Well, there are several. One was to institutionalize or depoliticize the office. This office is not a federal jobs program. This office helps advance public safety. It helps advance the quality of life in neighborhoods, you know, across this country. And it should be evaluated in terms of what it does in that regard. So it really tried to convey that message. Secondly, was to ensure that the office was the voice for law enforcement inside the Beltway, certainly with inside the Justice Department. More than any other single agency, we deal directly with the local law enforcement agencies. Our funding grants go directly to them. They're not in the form of block grants. Our technical assistance projects go directly to those agencies. And not just the director, but the people in this office. We have a number of people with law enforcement backgrounds, a number of people with academic backgrounds who have direct connections. And so this business of being the voice. And thirdly and lastly was to bring this concept of evidence-based practice, which, and that's not unique to the COPS office, but this idea about what works and what works best and how do we make that part of law enforcement thinking. There's sort of a fourth strategic area that was not certainly wasn't on my radar when I first came to Washington, but it has quickly become that, and that's helping law enforcement agencies deal with the realities of what the economy is doing. It's producing a profound change, and one that I think, like I said a minute ago, is not clearly defined yet. Its outcome is not clearly defined yet.
I'd like to unravel a little bit, because you did mention that the COPS program, the grant program, and particularly the COPS hiring program, it's not a jobs program per se. But can we talk a little bit about it, let our audience understand a little bit more? And more particularly, how does it seek to increase the capacity for local law enforcement?
I think that's a great question, and I think it really goes back to where we started about the 100,000 officers. And the idea behind the 100,000 officers was absolutely sound, and it was absolutely necessary. And I lived through all of that as a line officer. I was a lieutenant at the time when all that was going on. But the hiring program is quite simple. Any agency in the country can apply for a COPS grant. The life of the grant is 3 years. The agency has to commit to funding for a fourth year at local funds. At various times over the life of the COPS office, there have been phases where there was no match and cap, local match required, no cap. At other times, there have been both of those present. There are really two main statutory requirements. One is that 50% of the money has to go to agencies that serve populations below 150,000 and 50% above. And secondly, that any state and territory of the United States that has at least one eligible applicant is guaranteed up to 0.5% of the money. It's called the state minimum. What we've tried to change over the last 3 years is the idea was, obviously, you had to have a community policing plan, what you intended to do. But that was very broadly defined. What we've tried to do over the last 3 years is challenge these agencies to focus on specific community problems that they're trying to address and say, how are you going to address those? The state of the economy has made that approach better, I mean, more meaningful in many ways, because we can't solve, as I said a second ago, like we can't solve everybody's local budget problem. But we can, what we can do is to help you if you want to focus on homicide, if you want to focus on vehicle burglary, if you want to focus on school policing, articulate the problem and articulate, instead of thinking about this as some kind of long-term permanent addition to your department, think about it as a four-year problem-solving grant. And how, what you could do with these extra resources over 4 years, what community issue could you address?
We know there's no easy way to assess the extent to which law enforcement agencies are successfully practicing community policing. However, COPS has worked with practitioners and others to develop the Community Policing Self-Assessment Tool. Can you tell us more about this tool, any additional requirements it places on applicants, and how the introduction of this tool captures community policing progress within law enforcement agencies? And also, how does it help COPS grantees?
In some ways, for the longest time, and I don't think it's unique to COPS, the truth of the matter is that we measured the success of our grant programs by, you know, did we get the authorized funding out the door? Did we get it to our recipients? You know, did they spend the money in the fashion that they said they would? In general terms, were they timely? And did we, in other words, manage the grant from a technical process-driven standpoint? The CPSAT, or Community Policing Self-Assessment Tool, is really the first attempt to measure the effectiveness of a specific grant on a specific agency. And so the way it works is that we worked with the Police Executive Research Forum and a number of academics to develop a measuring a tool. It is a self-assessment tool. The agency and its community essentially measure sort of the state of being at the time at the beginning of the grant. The idea is that at the end of the grant, you will take the same self-assessment tool and see if over that three-year period, has there been an improvement? Has there been a positive change? It's the first attempt to really measure that. It is not particularly burdensome. We think it takes about a half hour per individual to complete that form. The number of individuals that take it vary from agency to agency. But we want to see if that tool and that measurement will give us some the ability to establish a sort of a community policing baseline. Another thing that we're doing sort of related to that is to try to develop some metrics. I mean, you made an interesting observation and a very valid one, which is that it's very hard to measure the success of community policing. Probably the most common way to do that has been sort of community opinion polls. You know, do you like your police department? That's not a bad measure, but it's certainly not complete. We hope CPSAT is a step in that direction. But another one is we're trying to work. One of the projects that we funded is to try to measure to create some other metrics for how do you measure community policing success. I mean, one of mine, this is just the Bernard Malekian view of the world and not particularly scientific. But I think, for example, if an agency has a homicide problem and its detectives have a high solvability rate, they are clearing a lot of those cases. That suggests to me that those detectives or the line patrol officers have relationships in the community that is putting information into that police department that's allowing them to solve those crimes. We want to see if that metric is valid and what other metrics there might be to start to develop a scorecard on whether community policing is, in fact, successful.
Continuing down that path, to be a good steward of public funds requires your office to consistently monitor the progress of grants and grantees. Can you further elaborate on your office's grants monitoring strategy? And what have you done to enhance the way that your office monitors grants?
I think, and we think, that the monitoring of our grant dollars, and particularly with our focus over the last few years on specific problem solving, that our monitoring activities are critical. It is not just enough to say, did we get the money out the door, and did the required forms and processes come back? We really We're currently monitoring, for example, over $266 million in outstanding grants. We do this through a series of what are called desk audits, where we sit and look at what the agencies say they're doing. And we also do site visits, where we send teams of people to the agencies to visit them. Currently, this year, we're planning over 150 site visits to different agencies to see specifically what they're doing, not just what the paperwork says they're doing, but are they doing it? There are agencies, and I don't want to identify anyone on the air, but there are agencies who have committed to taking the entire block of COPS-funded officers to create problem-solving, problem-focused units. That's absolutely fabulous on paper. Part of our site visit strategy is to go and look and see what are they actually doing. I believe that it is not enough to say how many officers did the COPS fund the hiring of. We have to say what did those officers accomplish, and are the communities and neighborhoods that those officers police, are they safer? So all of that is tied up into our monitoring strategy. You know, one last thing, it's been, you know, a fairly newsworthy item that travel restrictions are, you know, the federal government is under some mandate to, you know, bring its travel costs down. I will say that the Department of Justice has made it clear, and the Attorney General has made it clear, that monitoring of grants is an absolute top priority. We have sort of exempted monitoring visits from our overall travel cost reduction strategy.
COPS has historically provided outreach to law enforcement agencies to expand the adoption of community policing nationwide. Can you elaborate on how the COPS Community Policing Development Program advances the practice of community policing? And also, what kinds of training and technical assistance do you provide?
You know, the community policing development grants really span a very wide spectrum of activities and projects. One of the ones from this year that I'm most proud of is Hawthorne, California, came up with something called Coffee with a Cop, an incredibly simple idea that if you would allow a format, you'd get a local restaurant to sort of donate some space. You would advertise this, you know, this coffee that the representatives from the police department would be there and people could just come in and have a cup of coffee. I remember when I first saw that, I don't think I ever said this to the chief, but when I first saw it, I thought, well, okay, this might be interesting, but is it really going to catch on? It has caught on nationwide. I mean, it's exactly what we wanted to come out of the community policing development plans. Because it is so simple and it is so one-to-one. I mean, at the end of the day, police work is really about relationships. Effective police work is about relationships. And people come in droves to every city that's done it. We have a program in Houston with some kids who were absolutely out at risk, teens in police school. It's officers and a group of teens, and quite frankly, some of these kids have come down a hard road. But I had the privilege of going to their graduation ceremony with 30 of them. And I think they started with 30. I think 25 graduated. And whether or not, whatever comes out of that, it is very clear. It was very clear from talking to the kids. It was very clear from talking to the officers that they have a different view of each other. I think a lot of these programs that put officers, and particularly kids, but officers and members of the public together, it almost doesn't matter what the program is. If everybody will just stop their role-playing for 5 minutes and sort of see the humanity of each other, I think it's enormously powerful. We funded a project last year, for example. One of the responses to the economy has been some cities around the country forming joint police fire agencies, sometimes called public safety agencies, and cross-training their personnel. It's not without controversy from both the fire side of the house and the police side of the house, but we funded Michigan State to actually produce a national report on where that model has worked, where that model has failed, and why. We think that report will be enormously valuable to the field, to city managers and county administrators as they try to make decisions about how to manage their local budgets. So I don't know. I hope that helps.
Yeah, I was wondering actually, Bernard, if there were other some sort of key success stories that you'd like to share about the COPS program in action.
You know, I think one of the there are so many areas where the infusion of just a little bit of money and a whole lot of time and talent has made a huge difference. I think one area that my learning curve has been very steep about, I knew very little about the challenges faced by tribal law enforcement across this country. It is really not something that a lot of people think about. Certainly was not something I thought about in Los Angeles County. But when you study the challenges that tribal agencies face, and then you look at the COPS office this year put more than $25 million into augmenting the resources of tribal agencies across this country to develop community policing plans in Indian country, it's been incredibly rewarding. And it's very clear. This is part of this isn't just a COPS program. I mean, there's a White House initiative on reaching out to tribes. DOJ is very much, Department of Justice is very much involved in being part of that. But it is really clear that it's made a huge difference in the lives of some tribes. The crime rates and the rate of victimization, particularly of women in Indian country, is awful. And to be able to be part of that and to hopefully make a difference is a real challenge for this office and one I think we're up to.
How has the era of fiscal austerity changed the way law enforcement agencies operate? We will ask Bernard Malekian, Director of the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, VA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department. All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Bernard Malekian, Director of the Office of Community-Oriented Policing, or COPS Program, within the U.S. Department of Justice. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Melinda Balthrop. Technology has the capability of being a force multiplier. And to that end, Bernard, what are you doing to increase the capacity of law enforcement agencies to conduct data sharing? And more particularly, how are you helping them incorporate the use of technology in making their organizations more effective?
You know, that was an area that the COPS office was very deeply involved in for a number of years. We had a number of almost $1.3 billion passed through the COPS office over a 15-year period, specifically focused on technology grants and on the development of different things. Unfortunately, that came to an end in 2010 with the ban on earmarks because most of those technology projects were specifically focused. I've articulated that I've made some reference here today to the changes that are occurring in police work as a result of the economy. And one of those areas is technology. Probably the poster child for what's happened to the economy is Camden, New Jersey. One of the highest violent crime rates in the United States, and they had to lay off laid off 47% of their police department. I mean, every officer with less than 14 years on the job lost their job. I mean, in one day. One of their responses, and they've got a very bright and energetic chief up there who's really, really doing amazing things under very difficult circumstances. But they attempted to use closed-circuit television cameras to help deploy their radio cars rather than doing random patrol. They're trying to monitor activities in public areas. things like taking reports online, particularly where there's no suspect information. I mean, that's just a couple of quick examples. So while we don't have the technology grants anymore, we're certainly focused in the area of technical assistance, of trying to bring awareness of different technologies or different projects or different funding streams, even if those funding streams are outside the COPS office, to the awareness of those agencies. That's kind of an example of what I meant when I said earlier that we wanted to be the voice of and for, you know, law enforcement, the place to call. Even if we don't have the money, maybe we can point them in the right direction for some help.
Bernard, I know your office is often a gatherer and disseminator of best practices and a convener on issues of critical importance. Can you elaborate on the ways your office shares best practices and knowledge within the law enforcement community? And among other things, how does the COPS community policing web-based portal system factor into those efforts?
You know, the web-based portal system is really focused on grants and allowing the grantee to sort of monitor their grants, to actually move their funds in accordance with the parameters of their grant. We are in the process of bringing our website, our web page up to speed. To allow links to various agencies, not just in COPS, not even just within DOJ, but across the federal government. There are, in the Office of Justice Programs, for example, there are something called the Smart Police Initiative that is trying to also collect best practices. And so we're trying to become a place where the stories from our grants and how they, what they've impacted, what people may have learned, the reports from our community policing development, all of that will be linked on our website, as well as links to other government agencies. One of the broader initiatives of the Justice Department is to try to create a best practices database where agencies who are trying to deal with a particular issue can come online and be put in touch with other agencies who may have dealt with the same problem. So that's the focus. It's a little distinct from the web portal, which is really a grant management tool.
Bernard, given the recent economic downturn, how has policing fundamentally changed over the last few years? And more importantly, what are you doing to assist local law enforcement agencies to meet the demands of this new fiscal reality?
Well, if I back up a little bit and talk about what's happened to the law enforcement agencies, we did it was originally what's called a data call. We were asked for some numbers for another government agency on how many police officers across the country had lost their jobs. And what we discovered was that there was no sort of annual data collection on that. So we undertook the development of a report that came out in the fall of last year. And what we learned, and we know these numbers are low, but at least 12,000 officers across the United States in the previous 24 months had been laid off, actually lost their jobs. An additional 35,000 positions had gone unfilled, meaning somebody retires or leaves the agency and they simply doesn't get funded. And then lastly, at least 28,000 officers had been furloughed for 40 hours or more in the preceding 12 months. So it's enormous loss of capacity. The changes are going to occur, we believe, across sort of four fronts. One is a greater reliance on technology, which you alluded to earlier. Two is greater use of civilians, both as employees and as volunteers. There are a number of agencies that are doing some extraordinary things with civilian volunteers and with civilian employees. The third thing is an alternative response to non-emergency radio calls. And the last and probably most controversial is this regionalization and consolidation of departments in across a number of fronts. These things are occurring. These things aren't, we're not projecting. These things are underway. So we try in the COPS office, and I mentioned one of them, is to ensure that our hiring grants are really become problem grants, not budget fixing grants. But how can we help a community deal with a specific problem? And secondly, how can we provide technical assistance for agencies that are struggling with a particular issue, and how can we put them in touch with somebody else who may have dealt with a similar issue? all of this are convening, and I haven't even mentioned that part, but one of the things that we do fairly regularly is bring groups, law enforcement groups, around particular issues. For example, within the last year, and I think this is an area that is receives not enough attention, but we brought in a group of police labor leaders to talk about what the impact of law enforcement on employee groups was and on their philosophy and how they're going to work together with management. Each of these convenings produces some kind of a report that goes back out to the field or gets reported at a national conference, either ours. Next week we'll be at the International Association of Chiefs of Police Conference. We're making presentations there. So all of that goes to make sure that the COPS office is sort of a continual source of information and assistance.
As a follow-on to that, in this current fiscal environment, as you described, it can no longer be business as usual. So focusing internally, what steps have you taken to minimize operational costs or seek out efficiencies and cost savings within your office?
Well, we've been focused on that for the last 3 years, even before the formal mandates came down. We have reduced our travel costs significantly and more efficiently. We have really streamlined our training costs. We have reduced our we came in this year, we reduced our budget about 9%, actually. And so we've really tried to recognize that we need to be stewards of federal money. We haven't added any new employees in over a year. We're in the process of doing an internal realignment to acknowledge where the workloads have gone and sort of redistribute that. I think we really have been one of the leaders in terms of following the president and the attorney general's mandates about achieving greater efficiencies.
In an effort to accomplish your mission, you've implemented the principles of effective COPS leadership and leadership principles in action. Would you tell us more about these efforts? And more importantly, how do they seek to increase your employees' leadership aptitude?
You know, one of the things that I think that this new economy is going to produce across the board is a fundamental shift away from sort of traditional top-down management. And I think empowering employees, I mean, the COPS leadership talks about empowering staff. It talks about effective communication. It talks about being fairness. There's about 7 points in all of that. And one of the things that we do, for example, we have regular internal climate surveys. And sometimes they reveal issues that are not particularly, you know, comfortable to deal with. You can float along. One of the things I've learned over the years about, you know, about being the leader of the organization is it doesn't take very much to convince yourself that everything is absolutely okay. And you have to take some steps to make sure you don't fall into the trap of actually believing that. Because people are challenged. I mean, this is a very stressful time. I think one of the more unfortunate things is, as we have a discussion about what should the role of government be and all that kind of stuff, it become somewhat fashionable to sort of bash the idea of the federal employees. You can talk about federal budgets without necessarily demeaning the people that do the work. And it's hard on people. I mean, it really is very hard on people. So trying to make sure that we stay abreast with what people's concerns are, what sometimes it may be as little as seemingly mundane as, you know, we say that we want to ensure fairness, for example. And then you may find that you have some internal policy like parking spaces or something, you know, something not particularly dramatic, but it's very dramatic in an individual's life. And particularly if they don't think that you're ensuring fairness. So it's a continual sort of scrutiny of the values, number one, but not just are we saying them, but are we doing them?
Federal agency managers are now demonstrating measurable improvements in programs by integrating data-driven analytics in decision-making. Can you talk about how your office is leveraging the power of analytics to enhance your programs and the law enforcement community at large?
I think the CPSAT tool that you asked about earlier, I think, is an example of that. We're working very hard to make sure that the grant application itself actually becomes very informative for us and for trends. So we ask a lot of information about crime rates. We actually ask a lot of information about changes in local budgeting and about local problems, the local problem identification. And we're really trying very hard to make those applications a rich source of data. One of the changes that the COPS office has led the way in, many grant applications are narrative driven. You have a question and it requires a sort of a written articulated response. And then somebody has to assess that response and decide, you know, is it meaningful or not? We've tried to go with a data driven approach to our application so that not only can we more meaningfully score the individual applicant, but we can take the grant data in the aggregate and hopefully draw some conclusions about what challenges are our stakeholders facing. I think that's probably one of the biggest areas that we've looked at. And secondly is developing this problem-solving metrics to actually look at how are our grants making a difference? How are they helping people in individual neighborhoods and communities?
So, Bernard, would you elaborate on the concept of police legitimacy?
We don't do that part through the grant process, although we do insist that that the applications be done properly and that you do with the things with the money that you're saying you're doing and all that. And I have to say that we have almost no problems in that area. I think the question that you raise really goes to something that has emerged as a discussion point over the last couple of years, and that's this concept of what's called police legitimacy. And it really came out of some work by Professor Tom Tyler, who was at NYU and is now at Yale. He wrote a very fascinating book a couple of years ago called Why People Obey the Law. And one of the things that he found was that in interactions with the public, between the public and the police, it was less important what the outcome of that interaction was and more important about how that person felt they were treated. Some of my own work was in this area of what I call transactional inequality. And if I might take the liberty of telling a quick story for a minute, I was on active duty in Saudi Arabia in 1991 during Desert Storm. And towards the end of the deployment, we were allowed to go shopping in this downtown marketplace, and it was cordoned off by Saudi police. And somewhere along the line, I was taking a picture of the police station, and I found myself interacting, if you will, with the local police. Namely, they were yelling at me in Arabic and sticking guns in my face, and they were clearly not happy with me, but I wasn't clear why. And it turns out that it's illegal to take pictures of public buildings in Saudi Arabia. I didn't know that. It occurred to me later that my experience was not unlike what many people in this country every day face, which is I was interacting with law enforcement officers. I had no way of measuring their intent. I did not speak their language. I did not know the law. I just knew that I had made them unhappy, and I didn't really know how I was going to make them unhappy. And it occurred to me at that point, and I had been in police work about 20 years then. I had always tried to be fair and just and all those things, you know, all those good things. And I realized right then that that was one of the first times in my adult life that I had been ever on the receiving end of power. I had always thought I was just and fair, but I was just and fair because I chose to be. And I realized that the people that I deal with were dependent on how I treated them. And that was the situation that I was in Saudi Arabia. Well, Tyler's work on legitimacy expands on that. And he said that it's really not, if you stop somebody for a traffic ticket, for example, it's the person may or may not get the ticket. They may or may not believe that they deserve the ticket. What they really care about is how did the officer treat them during that stop? Do they believe that the officer really stopped them for the traffic ticket? Did they feel that the officer treated them with respect? Did the officer explain them? All of these things promote this concept of legitimacy. And we try very hard in the COPS office. We have been very big proponents about bringing this message of legitimacy and what Professor Tyler calls procedural justice to the community, making law enforcement aware of it, making law enforcement aware of how important it is. And I think particularly as our society becomes more and more diverse, that concept is going to become more and more critical.
What does the future hold for the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services? We will ask its director, Bernard Malekian, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, VA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department. All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Bernard Malekian, Director of the Office of Community-Oriented Policing, or COPS Program, within the U.S. Department of Justice. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Melinda Balthrop. So, Bernard, in an era of fiscal constraint, it's critical that agency leaders and program leaders like yourself act with strategic intent in order to keep their workforce motivated to meet mission. As you reflect on your leadership, would you tell us how you continue to keep your employees engaged?
You know, there are a couple of things that I think I do, but I have to repeat something I think I've said at least twice. The men and women at the COPS office don't need much effort on my part to be engaged. I mean, they really are engaged. And there are folks that have stayed there for years. There are people who have turned down promotions inside the federal government because they believe in the mission of what the office does. I think if I do anything at all, it's to, make it clear to the field as a whole, to the law enforcement profession as a whole, what we do to try to expand our area into, you know, it was not without comment to say, you know, the COPS office is not a grant-making agency. And people kind of went, what? I believe that we are a public safety agency in the sense that we advance public safety through community policing, and grant-making is one of our most powerful tools that we do that. But I think as the years have passed and people see law enforcement coming to the COPS office, asking for assistance, asking for advice, asking for perspectives on a particular issue, I think the folks that work there realize, you know, we really are making a difference. We really do count. And as they go out in the field, not just the director going out in the field, but our monitoring teams going out in the field, we tried to, one of the things is particularly with the travel restrictions, the shrinking travel budget, what I've tried to do is to take people from other parts of the office other than monitoring. And say you're going to be on part of the site visit team, so they can go out to the field and see what it is that's going on out there. See what it is. It isn't just some abstract piece of paper. It isn't the XYZ police department. It's these 20 or 30 people that they met while they were on a site visit. It's the neighborhood tour that they took. It's some issue that they looked at. But as I said, it doesn't take much. This is a pretty motivated group of folks.
So how are you leveraging partnerships to improve operations and outcomes?
We've got a whole section that does exactly that, that deals with nonprofits, deals with major corporations. We don't take funds from them, obviously. We're the federal government. But what we try to do is to bring their expertise together with local law enforcement and with our own piece and sort of facilitate local law enforcement developing its own partnerships. There are corporations whose corporate philosophy is that 5% of their after-tax profits goes back into the local community for public safety projects. And they have, we have been enormously successful at pairing them up with local law enforcement agencies to try to deal with things that they don't have. We funded a project on police foundations, which is a growing thing across the country. I had one in Pasadena